So the verdict at the end, again, interesting verdict, which implies kind of that the writer has a position of authority in which to pass judgment. Zelensky is in a state of existential nihilism. Political rhetoric has been completely supplanted by archaic magical rhetoric. He no longer appeals to law, the logic of war, or Western partners. He appeals to the miracle of the enemy's death, a sign of the collapse of rational strategy. And basically it says that it won't end well for Zelensky. I will not tax your patience by reading any more. But who wrote this, let's say, rather extraordinary screed? Well, it's one Ruslan Pankratov. Now, he's described as a political scientist, international relations expert, and expert on the Baltic states, trained as both psychotherapist and information analyst. No doubt leaped tall buildings at a single bound as well. Look, he was a high-profile member of the Russian community in Latvia. He was a member of the Riga City Council for years, and he was author of the book Descendants of the Salaspils Prison Guards, Everything You Need to Know About Latvia, a title which in and of itself I think tells you everything you need to know about Ruslan Pankratov. You know, Latvians are clearly all still Nazis, descended from Nazis and such like. Now, he spoke out in favour of the invasion of Ukraine and was arrested by the Latvian authorities. And in 2023, he apparently swam across the border with Russia in a wetsuit and requested political asylum. So he's now another one of this collection of tame émigré pundits singing for both their supper and security. So does this just, I don't know, count as fun in the Russian propaganda noosphere? A weird pseudo-scholar indulging himself? I don't know, maybe Moskovsky Komsomolets needed some extra text. Maybe someone owed someone a favour, oh, I don't know. But I wonder if there is something more to it. I mean, yes, this is barking mad. But nonetheless, I can't help but feel that I've seen more of this bizarre occultic narrative attempts to explain the world, creeping out of its usual niche, publications like, yes, Tsargrad or Argumenti Facti, I'm looking at you, into more mainstream outlets. In the last, I don't know, very subjectively, year and a half. Why is that? Well, in some ways, I'm going to be deploying one wacky psychosocial explanation to try and explain another. But I wonder if it reflects the, and I'm going to get pretentious here, the epistemic tension within the Russian intelligentsia these days. They know so much of what is said to them, especially about the so-called special military operation, is absolute nonsense. But it's not just that they don't have the courage to call it out. It's also that they don't necessarily regard the regime as totally alien or evil. They are still patriots, ultimately. Now, that in many ways is not new. But crucially, they don't have a faith in order to mediate this tension. So let me just stop there. We'll have a break. And then let me dig more into this.
Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode.
So why are we seeing, or seem to be seeing, more of these occultic and arcane attempts to explain the world? Well, as I say, I mean, in some ways it is precisely about this tension. It is a lot easier to navigate a world that doesn't seem to make sense if you have faith. Faith, after all, says, don't worry your pretty little head about this. Yes, of course, there are, well, if we can quote Hamlet, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. In other words, there are things you're not meant to know. Just relax and go with the flow. So unthinking religiosity does the trick, accepting that there is an ineffability about the world. And in many ways, the more counterintuitive the world seems, the more it doesn't seem to make sense, the more precious is the faith that accepts it. And once, yes, there was Russian Orthodoxy. Then there was an ideology that, for me, frankly, was a faith. You know, the party is always right. The seeming contradictions are just part of the complexities of the dialectic and will be worked out once thesis and antithesis have brought forth synthesis. You know, Marxism, Leninism, and frankly, the very fact that we saw Lenin's pickled body stuck in a mausoleum as a secular saint, you know, it was always, for all its invocations of scientific materialism, just as much a faith as Russian Orthodoxy. Now, there is knowledge without faith. There is doubt without safe spaces in which to express or explore it. So what fills this gap? What cognitive dissonance kicks in? It's quite hard to be unflinchingly honest with yourself and recognise both that something is wrong, but that, away from the kitchen table, one is too scared to say so. So something emerges to fill that gap, and we've seen this before, particularly in the late 80s and the 1990s. I think it's often forgotten just how far occultism and mysticism suddenly became so, so widespread in late Soviet times and then early post-Soviet Russia. We had the huge audience for Kashpirovsky, this TV hypnotist who said that through the medium of the TV set, he could cure your ills. We had renewals of efforts to prove that, for example, the Tunguska explosion in 1908, this massive explosion that levelled huge areas of forest and was almost certainly a meteor hitting. But that nonetheless, it was claimed, of course, that was a UFO. We had all kinds of weird and not so wonderful stories proliferating, again, even in the mainstream press, often under such slightly kind of deniable rubrics like, не может быть, it can't be true, about, for example, giant mutant rats in Moscow sewers or cannibal cults in farthest Far East and that kind of thing. Now, look, today there's still a healthy or maybe sometimes unhealthy side industry in palmistry, tarot, faith healing and the like. But again, that's hardly unique to Russia. And then, look, and I discussed this from a different angle back in, I had to look it up, August 2021 in Moscow Shadows number 41, in which there is a political dimension. I talked about red battle witches supporting the Communist Party and shamans seeking to exorcise Putin. So there's been something of a return of this. And back then, I suggested that, well, what are the, as a result of? Well, one of them is anomy, the sense of rootlessness, of being lost and undisconnected. There's nothing in which you can believe. Secondly, pattern recognition. That sense that, in fact, you can see a logic to a world that sees none, even if you have to invent it. It's a very human thing. We tend to create patterns where they may not exist. And if I were a cynic, I'd suggest that a lot of the so-called Kremlinology is often just actually making up explanations for what are often disconnected factoids. And also, more broadly, in an age of growing uncertainty about the future, war, inflation, what's going to happen after Putin, that kind of thing, it is comforting to tell yourself that you somehow know some arcane hidden truth. It's to feel that you have just a little bit more control over this uncertain future. So understanding politics based on that handful of data points becomes akin to, I don't know, predicting futures based on the flights of birds or the state of a sacrificial goat's liver. But that was then.
Since then, I would suggest that the world, and one could frankly argue not just for Russians, has become an even more confusing and complex place. Especially when, as Russians are, you face a regime that is not just actively deceitful, but that is also instinctively prone to secrecy. Secrecy creates another vacuum. A vacuum that gets filled by half-truths, water cooler gossip, conspiracy theory, misunderstandings and misinformation. Remember, and this is something that Anna Arutunyan has pointed out, skepticism begets gullibility. Russians are used to being lied to, and therefore, and this is something that Putin himself also falls prey to, reflexively look for a deeper truth on everything. And so even when, as is usually the case, what you see is what you get, there is that sense that there needs to be something deeper. I mean, I once heard this. I had the very unlikely and one-off opportunity to talk to someone who had actually in the past briefed Vladimir Putin. And what really came out from this conversation was that sense that for Putin, there was always some deeper, but what do they really want kind of meaning. Whereas, in fact, the world often is relatively straightforward. But no, this is the trouble. Putin will create artificial meanings because he can't accept that what you see is what you get. Anyway, so this is something that actually I think we find generally amongst Russians, especially these days. Every news story has to have been ordered by someone who sort of paid for it. Every suicide is a Kremlin murder. I mean, it's not just Russians who fall prey to that particular one. Every corruption prosecution is actually a bit of score settling. Every business collapse is really because of corporate raiding or some kind of insider conspiracy. As I said, this has been a pattern for a while. It is, I would suggest, increasingly significant. After all, first of all, Russians are living in times of increasing uncertainty. And ironically, the very prospect of an end to the war in Ukraine, with that constant on again, off again, will there be a deal, will there not be a deal, simply has added to that. Secondly, there is a growing sense of the unreality of official discourse, of the disconnect between what Putin says about how everything's going to be fine and the lived experience of Russians themselves. Because after all, their lives are one of increasing insecurity. Yes, a lot of this is about the economy. But it's also about, well, will the war shift to a mobilization phase? Will it also lead to increasing repression? This is the irony. It's not that, for example, in recent years, I would suggest there's that much more oppression as such. It is more about the drip, drip, drip effect on people's psyches of continued period of low-level, sporadic, and often unpredictable repression. And the degree to which this creates, I suppose it's a kind of samosud. Samosud was the peasant self-justice of the village back in Tsarist times. So, you know, a horse thief, you wouldn't bother trying to hand over to the authorities. You would hang them yourself. There were crimes that the village itself policed. Well, in some ways, we have a kind of bizarre self-policing these days, but a political self-policing more often. They may not be told to do so, but school administrators, office managers or whatever, trying to police the political views, even the morality of those under them, because they think that that's what they're expected to do, or they fear that's what they're expected to do, and therefore they will do it. So that actually you have a state, for example, that is committed to a natalist policy, that is encouraging people to have more kids, but is not bringing about the kind of deeply intrusive social controls that, for example, we have seen in China. But on the other hand, people may well think, well, I'm expected to police the wombs of my employees, and that therefore I will try and encourage them to have kids. So, you know, you actually have all these kind of tensions in that. It's the whole notion of, you know, there was the notion of Stalinism from below, Putinism from below, if Putinism existed. Now, look,
This is therefore contributing, I'd say, to this increasing sense of a world that makes no sense unless you start to step beyond the normal bounds of rationality. A belief that is both mirrored and then magnified in the media, that it's all about plots and arcane conspiracies. Now, that said, do they actually believe in, well, Pankratov's, you know, black masses and so forth? No, of course not. They are not imbeciles. But believe that, for example, the West is trying to bleed both Russians with Ukrainians, but also Ukrainians by fighting the Russians, because in fact the West fears and hates all Slavs. Oh, well, that's perhaps within the realms of what people might think of, shall I say, kind of acceptable conspiracy theory. Or indeed that China is manipulating Russia and the West to bring them both down in order to expedite its own rise. Just generally, that all Russian politics is because of the manipulations and manoeuvres of clans and cabals. Yes, this kind of falls within that category. And the great virtue of these kind of conspiracy theories and this kind of occult, arcane understanding of the world is that it leaves the ordinary person essentially impotent. Now, why is it good to be impotent? It is because it's your excuse not to act. It's your excuse to be able to opt out. To basically, yeah, maybe you have to mouth what the platitudes of the moment and the slogans, but basically speaking, you can opt out of the wider world of politics with a big or a small p and instead just focus on your day-to-day life, because there's nothing you could do anyway. Remember, yes, Russians continue to protest and resist against Putinism in all its various manifestations. And I'm using Putinism just simply as a shorthand for the things that the Putin regime does, but also particularly about the war in Ukraine. Most of them are not, because they have convinced themselves, in most cases, I think probably rightly, that actually it's more dangerous than it's worth and that they basically can't achieve anything. If you feel impotent, it's good to be able to justify it as the fact of because the world is this complex and conspiratorial place. However, what I think is also worth noting is that this pattern that we've seen within Russia, and this is actually something that really concerns me, is also being manifest in a tendency from some quarters in the West to grasp on arcane and even occasionally occult explanations for how Russia operates. Now, arcane explanations are, for example, that, you know, it's all about the money. It's not about any of the ostensible grounds. It's about wanting to take Donbass for its coal and other raw materials, or Crimean annexation was really about Black Sea hydrocarbons and such like, which I really don't think holds water. But nonetheless, it's one way of trying to explain that it's all about something else, really. Or it's all about clans struggling for power in Moscow and such like. But then you also have this sort of semi-occult, psychodramatic explanations of Russia. You know, and when people, and they do, talk about Putin's Russia being a nihilistic death cult, they don't, well, apart from the occasional loony, mean this literally, envisaging dark masses in the main military cathedral, or Putin's Sardaukar soldiers receiving a sacrament of victims' blood in Red Square. Sardaukar getting sacrament of blood was a particularly effective scene in the latest Dune film, which is, if the reference passed you by, as it might well. But instead, what they do is they claim that Putinism, and they often actually do think that it is an ism, is characterised somehow specially or uniquely by the glorification of death, of sacrifice, of military martyrdom. It's more than just a victory cult, glorifying successes in wars like the Great Patriotic War, but it's outright, well, the term sometimes used is thanatopathy. Always mistrust anything that needs the creation of a whole new word to explain it. An ideological glorification or obsession with death, especially in the context of war, as somehow something noble, purifying, a valuable achievement in itself rather than something to be feared. The sociologist Dina Khapaeva
describes this as an elevation of the death drive to a heroic ideal, offering, quote, the joy of death instead of, another quote, a meaningless, hopeless, impoverished life. And the idea being that this therefore justifies wasteful tactics, which sees human life being traded for a meter of territory here or there, the so-called death economy, whereby people essentially decide to go and fight, even with the sense that they may well die because of the money they're being paid, or even the atrocities being carried out by Russian troops, on a sense that it has desensitized the population widely to the death of their own. I will be honest. I regard this as obscene, wholly inaccurate, and an ideological construct every bit as pernicious and scandalously xenophobic as anything you'd hear from Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova or the aforementioned Vladimir Solovyov. First of all, the idea that, oh well, the state elevates sacrifice in time of war is something particularly distinctive about Russia. Look, this is nonsense. I mean, why should we be surprised if the Russian state tries to basically say that this is a righteous struggle and therefore these are righteous deaths? Dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. It is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. I mean, that was a line from the Roman poet Horace that was then made famous by Wilfred Owen's World War I poem, exposing it as what he called the old lie, but one that was nonetheless at the time mobilised by British politicians. Look, of course, in times of major war, when you're trying to get people to hurl themselves into a meat grinder, you are going to tell them that it is for some grand purpose. And there's very little evidence that it's something special here. I mean, Chapayeva, for example, raises as evidence a speech that Putin delivered in front of the mothers of fallen soldiers, in which he essentially told them, this is a quote, "Your son lived and his goal has been achieved, and that means he did not leave life in vain." But let's be honest, what is he meant to say? Sucks to be you and your kid died for nothing? Of course not. Then the idea that Russians live meaningless, hopeless, impoverished lives, such that death is a release, is appallingly elitist and dehumanising. Who is to say that an unemployed farm worker in Thiva's backwoods, precisely the kind of person most likely to sign up, is living a hopeless, let alone meaningless, life? You know, why does the state have to offer so much money to overcome people's resistance to go and fight if they are all brainwashed suicide drones? It just doesn't add up. And more to the point, it is deeply orientalising. It is assuming that Russians are alien, that they are so different from us, so different from everyone else. They're not. They live in difficult times, but not terrible times. You know, people who describe Russia as some kind of backward hellscape just don't know what they are talking about. It's a common conceit. I mean, I remember there was this article in Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, back in 2019, that claimed that a quarter of all Russian homes didn't have indoor toilets. And that's a stat, a factoid, a deeply misleading factoid, that has been time and time again reused to prove that somehow Russia is still some kind of 19th century backwater. Well, apart from that was old data. But more to the point, it was, as I say, very misleading, because homes, that category of homes that the statistic was drawn from, includes people's dachas. A lot of people have a second home in the countryside, which is much more likely to have an outhouse rather than plumbed toilets inside the dwelling. But that does not mean that people are forced to live in atrocious conditions. It's just simply that they're second homes. And, you know, there are also some cases in particularly far-flung villages in especially hard-to-reach territory where there isn't the same plumbing. Sure, I'm not going to say that Russia is too entirely West European standards, let's say. But the point is, it fit a nice, neat vision
of what Russian life is like, when the idea that there's a real Russia away from glitzy Moscow and St. Petersburg, and that therefore people didn't interrogate it. So, sorry, that was a little ranty sideline. But the idea is that Russians are just so alien in their life's styles and cycles than ours. Well, look, it's not true. Russians are, of course, exposed to often outre propaganda, and some will believe it. And often, though, it will be ignored or even mocked. Russian daily life is perfectly livable to most, and certainly no worse than in rural poverty in so many other parts of the world. But it's not moulded by the state, any more than every German who went through schooling in the 1930s became a lifelong diehard Nazi. Of course, some Russians do believe, and others, probably many others, will pretend to do so because that seems the safest option. But when it comes down to it, and I know it's a tremendously banal observation, but people are people. And above all, I think this notion of Russia, the death cult, and generally these kind of extreme ideological constructs demonstrate a perverse intellectual alliance between Putin's most devoted adherents and his most incontinent enemies. Both of them choose to believe that what the state decrees, society believes. So, of course, the same logic would suggest that the Soviet population were totally committed to Marxism-Leninism, and that the Soviet Union wasn't underpinned by corruption, careerism, absenteeism, despair, suicide, alcoholism and defection. And so elections in modern Russia aren't rigged massively to create the illusion of widespread popular support. I mean, come on, you can't have it both ways. You can't claim that this is an illegitimate regime that distorts the democratic process, that oppresses its masses, and yet at the same time say that these people are all entirely hook, line and sinker taken in by official propaganda. Or can you have it both ways? Because again, this is where faith comes in. Faith allows you to reconcile the irreconcilable. Now, the reason I'm tearing into the obscurantist, occult-adjacent explanations of modern Russia isn't just because I don't see why we in the West should try and lower ourselves to the frothing lunacies of the Ruslan Pankratovs and their ilk, but also because this kind of pseudo-analysis gets in the way of our understanding the complexities of modern Russia and how it really works. First of all, if we believe that this is actually a faith-based project, then we exclude any scope for negotiation, compromise, and pragmatic engagement. It is a war to the knife or nothing. Secondly, we also misunderstand the system and therefore fail to be able to predict its actions and its reactions. And that's dangerous for us. Look, if you genuinely believe that Putin believes all this nonsense and that thus isn't afraid to die because he believes in the value of sacrifice and the fact that he will be welcomed into heaven by that sacrifice, then what is there to stop him from unleashing his nuclear weapons? And if you think thermonuclear Armageddon is a serious possibility, and you don't want to die, of course, you are going to do whatever you can to talk him down from pressing the button. You give him an extraordinary degree of power. Thirdly, if you assume that all Russians buy this too, or a majority or a plurality or whatever, then basically you're in zombie movie territory. The best you can really hope for is to not die in this scene. How demotivating is that for our attempts to find some kind of, not just resolution to the war in Ukraine, but way of at least coexisting with the Putin state in as less dramatic and dangerous way as possible. And finally, it denies us the scope to try and open divides within Russia if we assume that the Russians have all been mobilised into this ideological project. I've banged on about this in the past, and I do think that it's something where the West has done far too little to try and fight a political war with the Kremlin. And we've just really thought that sanctions plus arming Ukraine plus stern lectures about international law is enough of a strategy without actually trying to reach out to ordinary Russians, both for the possibility of undermining the war effort now, but also to prepare the ground for post-war and above all post-Putin relationship with a country that isn't going away. So for all of these reasons, I don't really think it is helpful, just as it is certainly not accurate, to see Russia as a death cult. Russians, I can actually understand why they fall prey to the arcane and occult understandings of the world, because it does reflect that sense of insecurity and impotence. I don't think we have the same excuse. Now, maybe, of course, the people who are pushing the death cult line do so precisely because they don't want to end the war. They don't want any long-term accommodation. They just like seeing Russia isolated and Russians dying even at the cost of Ukrainian lives. But no, surely not. Surely that's just another conspiracy theory, isn't it? Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute,
no water. yüzünde. Alacaklarını topluyor özünde. Alacaklarını topluyor tepeden tırna. Borcum yok, bozdurdum ömrümü. Borcum yok, bozdurdum ömrümü. Gençliğim düştü payına. Tedarini hazırda.
You may not be looking for the promised land. But if blood comes, there is no interpretation.
Thank you. What the fuck is your name?
Ontdaan, zei wij, van liefde, leed en luister. Geen keel omhalst nog klank van onze naam. Geen licht valt in de val van zijn duister dat ons als vel omvliest.
Zo koud.
Bindt het lichaam in de ban van uw dodelijke blaam. Ik draag de warme doeken naar u toe. Ik ben het bloed. Het bloed dat ik doe. Het is ontzet uit alles wat ik was. Ik ben vergeten wie ik was, is, hoe ontdaan ik leef van u, uw strakke pas. Verfoeid zijn wij. Men doet het bij gebrek aan tijd. Het netwerk is een circus tent. Ogen en hart flikkeren op als gek. De spanning stijgt. Weldra komt het cement. Dan kan de vorm gegoten in de vent. Hij spookt in de stad. Er liggen flarden te rotten, waar de stem verhaarde tot gestalte. Vet slijk, waarin het pook is. Het stijve lijk der dode paarden. Zo roert hij nog de wereld aan de kook. Vervloekt zijn wij, dolgedraaid in onszelf, verwoord en daardoor in de ban gedaan van wat het woord benoemt. Een mager zelf dat buiten het beaam van de waan geen ruimte heeft, geen werkelijk bestaan. Ken jouw stem, jouw klank, jouw melodie. Jij bent het binnen dat ik buiten zie. Jij bent doorgang, engte, pas en ventiel. Ik word jouw onbegrensde grensgebied. Want het wiel is weg en de weg is jouw wiel. Weerloos is hij, in staat van genade. Heilige larve, enge tentatie, infestatie, hooggeleerde maden, vuil onder de nagels van de natie, puinwaaier, grijze sedimentatie, steuntrekker, lowlifer, verbaal kabaal, voor alle 7 dichters in de zaal. Hij breidt zich uit in tijd en ruimte. Hij explodeert, hij vlamt, hij gaat globaal. Flitspaal wordt hij. In de hippe ruimte. Vermoeid zijn wij. De ogen parelen troef in donker. Drijvend zoeken op gedachten die neerwaarts warrelen. Naar been in het woelen. Huid onder doeken. Wij vinden niets. Wij tieren. Wij vloeken. Faal kleeft ons het lichaam aan. Van de schermen. De wereld is een veelheid van zwermen. Er is angst. Het woord is dode letter. Hier ligt iemand eenzaam te kermen. En daar zinkt alles in slijm en in etter. Fragiel is hij, doorschijnend in de wind. Flarde doeken, dat wappert aan wat haken. Onzeker qua bestaan. Een wankel kind, trillend voor de hand die hard kan raken. En toch nog vreder zelf in het kraken van wat er onder hem nog zwakker is.